everybody. Welcome to Live from IPY with from Summit Station in Greenland. A few things about the program that Craig is involved in and about Polar Trek. Polar Trek is a professional development experience for K-12 educators, and we match them up with researchers so they can go get hands-on authentic experiences in the polar regions. And we're in our second year, so Craig Beals is in the second group of teachers, and we have one more year of the Polar Trek program. And you can learn more about it by going to the website and following all the expeditions at polartrek.com. Polar Trek is part of an international effort that's called the International Polar Year. The International Polar Year goes from 2007 to 2009, and it's celebrating the polar regions with scientific endeavors all over the Arctic and the Antarctic. And you can learn more about what is happening with the International Polar Year at ipy.org. And just to give you a sense of what's happening behind the scenes, this is the Polar Trek team. There's a bunch of us today. We have myself, Janet, Kristen's here, Tina's here, and then we have a new person that's not on our team, Kenan. And so we're working behind the scenes. Okay, at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Craig, and this is a slide of all the people that we expect to talk to today or that Craig works with, and I'll let Craig say hello and introduce everybody. So it's up to you now, Craig.
Well, thank you, guys. We're here. We've got 10 of us, and we're in the big house up at Summit Greenland. We'd like to thank everybody for joining us today. It's a beautiful, balmy minus 9C here, so it's a pretty nice day. The wind speeds are not too high, and we've had pretty nice weather the last couple days. We're at a place called Summit Camp Greenland, and the title of the research project that's been going on for the last couple years is Radical Chemistry Over Sunlit Snow. So that kind of sums up the things that we'll be talking about. We'll be talking about how the sunlight interacts with chemicals in the snow to change those chemicals, and then hopefully by the end we'll find out, well, what does that mean? We'll be up here from June 1st through July 12th, and so we can go to where we are.
Yeah, Craig, there's going to be a delay in the slides, so just keep flowing there.
Oh, all right. Okay, where we are, like I said, we're at Summit Greenland. If you look at the map there, we've put a star in the general area. Greenland is the largest island in the world, and one of the largest, or the largest ice sheet over land in the Northern Hemisphere. So you can see in relation to where you might be right now, where we are. We're up at 72 degrees north, so well up above the Arctic Circle. Summit Camp is located at the peak of Greenland's ice sheet, which is about 10,600 feet, and that means right about 2 miles of ice is underneath our feet right now before you hit the actual rock of Greenland. So we're way up in the air. I can say that it feels like we're higher than 10,600 feet. The air feels pretty thin, but we'll maybe talk about that more later on. The next one says, how did we get here? Well, people came from all over the place and met up in Schenectady, New York, and then we went to Stratton Air Force Base, where the New York Air National Guard operates large C-130 cargo planes that fly researchers and scientists and work crews all over the various places in the Northern Hemisphere, mainly Greenland, to do research. And some of those planes have skis on them, so they're able to land on the snowpack up here. And there is a long 3-mile runway where these planes land, and it is maintained daily by a crew with heavy machinery to ensure that the planes can come and go with ease. A few of the questions that I've run into throughout the journal time is things like, what is it like? You can see in the picture there, it's beautiful in its own special way. And this week, the average temperature has been about minus 20 C or minus 4 F, The wind has been relatively calm, about 8 miles per hour. We haven't had a lot of snowfall, but a little bit did. And also I have on there the effects of altitude. When we first arrived up here, most of us, especially us first-timers, found that we were very short of breath at this altitude, and it's taken several days to finally get used to the lack of air up here. But I think we're finally getting used to the air. Next one says, where do we eat? And this shows the inside of where we are right now. This is the big house, called that because it's big or bigger than the other places. It has the kitchen or the galley, and we have 2 meals a day prepared for us, and they've been absolutely fantastic. If you've been following the journal, I've kept up with all the food, and there have been a lot of comments about people's mouths watering as they've read that. It also has a nice large dining room. There's about 30 of us or so up here right now, and so that fits us pretty well. And then an office, which we're in right now. It also houses the shower and sink for brushing our teeth and those sorts of things. Next one is, where do we sleep? These are our tents. They're a double-walled tent, and they are designed to keep us warmer than the outside air, so it's better than sleeping on the ice or sleeping on the snow. And I have 2 sleeping bags. One is a minus 40 below sleeping bag, and then a fleece liner on the inside. And once I get those zipped up tight, they stay relatively warm. Sometimes you heat up water bottles and throw those in your bag to get it heated up before you get in, or climb in with those, because there is no heater in the tent. You just got to make do. Most people wear a couple layers to close the bed, and then, of course, have your stocking cap on. And the other thing is, it's extremely bright up here, 24 hours a day, so you got to find something to cover up your eyes. Barry, did you want to take over on this next one? Okay, Barry Leffer, who is the one of the scientists here that's working through this stuff and the one that was responsible for allowing me to come up here with the group this year, he's going to take over for a couple of these slides and talk about why we're here in Summit.
Barry. Thanks, Craig. This is a photo of Houston, Texas, my hometown. And as you can see, like other large cities in the U.S., we have an air pollution problem. And lots of people ask me, why do you go to Greenland to study air pollution? And before we get to that answer, I'm just going to go and tell you how we make the ozone that's in the smog that's dangerous for people to breathe. And so the next slide is the recipe for smog, and the first component is nitrogen oxides. Nitrogen oxides come from any kind of combustion. In most cities, the largest source of nitrogen oxides is either automobiles and your electric power plant, if it's coal or natural gas. So nitrogen oxides, and then the next slide is hydrocarbons. And hydrocarbons also come from automobiles. Some of the fuel is unburned. And other factories like oil refineries or chemical plants, and Houston also has a bunch of those as well. So again, you're thinking, what's going on? Greenland, we don't have cars, we don't have any factories or power plants, but we do have a lot of sunlight, and that's the next slide. Right now we have 24 hours of sunlight, and if you mix all those things together, you get ozone. And one of the things that people get confused about is they hear about how ozone's good. You know, up in the stratospheric ozone layer, ozone protects us from the harmful UV rays of the sun. Up here at Summit, the UV rays are very intense because we're higher up in the atmosphere and we have the snow, which is 95%+ reflective of UV. And so we got to be very careful to put on our sunscreen. And so we know we have sunlight up here at Summit. And then the next question is, the next slide, is there ozone in Greenland? And the answer is yes. So there's the ozone up in the stratosphere to protect us from the sun, but ozone down at the surface is bad for us because it's a really strong oxidant. It burns your lungs when you breathe it. It turns out there's ozone all over the world, but we want to understand what the ozone levels are in Greenland, primarily because the chemistry of the air is what gets recorded in the snow, and the snow gets turned into ice, and the ice makes those ice cores, ice cores, which gives us, so we got 2-mile-long ice core here in Greenland, and we use that to look back in time to see what the atmosphere was like. And so we want to help the scientists studying the ice cores understand the relationship between what's in the atmosphere and what's in the snow. So when they look at the chemicals in the ice core, they can say, this is what it means. And so to answer the question, is there smog in Greenland, or is, we're going to go to Bonnie Reichart, and she's going to talk about nitrogen oxide.
Hello, I'm Bonnie. I'm an undergrad at Georgia Institute of Technology, and I'm up here measuring nitric oxide, which scientists realized in the 90s actually does can be found at the poles. And so as you can see on the right, there's my instrument. It's red, and we pull in samples and create a reaction with ozone, which then the light produced from that tells us how much NO we have. Okay, so next slide. How does NO get here? And it comes from cars and factories and cities, and a very small amount is deposited on the ice sheet through acid snow, and then because of all the sunlight we have here, it's released back into the atmosphere here, and that's where I measure it. And next up is Kitty.
Hi, my name is Katrine, and I'm from the University of California, Irvine, where I'm a graduate student. And what I do here at Summit is I measure hydrocarbons. And when we get to the next slide, you'll be able to see the picture on the right. I am sitting next to my snake of canisters. And on this snake, there are 32 canisters, and I fill one canister with air every 4 hours. And then I take these canisters back to my lab at the University of California, Irvine, and I analyze them using gas chromatography for a suite of about 50 different hydrocarbons.
Summit, are you still there?
Okay. So, yeah, we're still here. We were having some slide problems.
Okay.
So moving on to the next slide, you might wonder, how do hydrocarbons get to Greenland? And what we see is that hydrocarbons build up during the winter time because they're transported in from cities in North America. And then during the summertime, when there's lots of sunlight, a number of different reactions start to occur, which ultimately produces ozone. And let's go back to Barry now, who's going to talk more about the third component in the recipe, which is the sunlight.
Thanks, Katrine. What I measure is sunlight. And you can see in that picture that we have all the different parts of the recipe to make ozone. We have nitrogen oxides, we have hydrocarbons, and we have sunlight, 24 hours of sunlight. So what you see on the right in that picture is an instrument that measures sunlight. It's above the snow and it's at 5 levels in the snow. It's called a spectroradiometer. The sunlight comes into the instrument through a fiber optic cable. I have a prism inside. It splits the sunlight into its different colors or different wavelengths, and I measure the intensity of the sunlight at the different colors. And because of the reflected snow and the high altitudes, even though we're far north, we get a lot of sunlight up here. And so, yes, we do make ozone. But the interesting thing, if you look in the next slide, when you look at that recipe, nitrogen oxides, hydrocarbons, and sunlight, we should be making a lot of ozone.
We're just waiting for your slides to catch up so people know what Harry's talking about.
And so when we look at that recipe and we calculate how much ozone we should have more ozone than what we measure. And so the question we had was, what could be destroying the ozone? And so the main purpose of this experiment was, and we were up here last year, looking for some ozone-destroying compounds. Specifically, we were looking for chlorine and bromine. Chlorine and bromine are in seawater, and even though we're a long way from the ocean, we only need a very, very tiny amount of chlorine and bromine to destroy one chlorine atom or one bromine atom destroys a lot of ozone. That's what caused the ozone hole up in the stratosphere. And so we were hoping to find a little bit of chlorine or bromine up here at Summit Greenland. To tell you more about the measurement methods to detect chlorine or bromine is Jochen Stutz, a professor from UCLA.
Thank you, Barry. Hello. The next slide actually shows Dave Tanner from Georgia Tech. He's one of the researchers working here. Unfortunately, Dave is desperately trying to fix an instrument that is broken, so he couldn't make it. As Barry already mentioned, we're looking for bromine and chlorine, and these molecules are here at very, very low concentrations, as they're very difficult to detect. So we actually brought up a couple of three different methods to detect bromine atoms and one indirect method. And what we're always trying to do is really identify these components. And what Dave is using, if we go to the next slide, please, he basically samples ambient air and then measures or separates the atoms in air by their weight and then counts each weight. So he actually counts bromine atoms that are in the air. And what you see in this slide are two curves. One is just a sample without ambient air, so clean air, and the blue curve shows you a sample or measurement with air. On the axis is basically the two peaks correspond to the two masses of bromine. So we are very certain that bromine is in the air here. The next slide is another method we're using, which is a little bit like what Barry's doing to measure sunlight. My group send a light beam through the atmosphere over a very long path here, and this year we're going over a path of 8 kilometers. We collect the light. Again, what you see on the right picture is basically a frame of our telescope. It's a fairly large telescope, 1.5 meter focal length. And then if we can go to the next slide, please. We take the light and we separate it in different wavelengths, different colors, and the bromine or bromine oxide, which is the molecule we're interested in, just wait a second, here's the slide, has a structure that identifies it like a fingerprint, basically. So it basically changes the color of the light in a very specific way, and we can use that to, number one, identify that this component is here and also to quantify this very accurately. Another method that we're using will be explained by Luke Ziemba from the University of New Hampshire.
Hello, my name is Luke Ziemba from the University of New Hampshire, and I run an instrument that we call mid-chamber ion chromatograph. And we use that instrument to measure several different gas phase compounds, like nitric acid or sulfur dioxide. But here, like we've talked about, we're mostly interested in bromine compounds. And we can measure those compounds that contain bromine that are water-soluble. And we measure those compounds at several different heights, two different heights at Summit, above the snowpack and below the snowpack, to identify better where these bromine compounds are coming from. And next up is Steve Brooks.
Hello, this is Steve Brooks. I work at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and I'm up here measuring mercury species in the air and the snowpack. Mercury is very unique, and one of its reactions is with bromine. The reaction with bromine causes a chain reaction that transports the mercury, which is in the air from long-range transport from things like coal combustion and ore processing, and it forces this mercury into the surface snow. Once mercury's in the surface snow, it has one of three fates. One positive fate is that the snowpack holds on to the mercury, which then becomes buried long-term, and so you are removing it from plants and animals. There is one fate that is basically neutral, and that is the sunlight effectively burns off the newly deposited mercury on the snow surface and returns it to the atmosphere. And there's one negative effect, that when mercury combines with bromine and deposits to a seasonal snowpack, and the snowpack holds onto the mercury, and when the snowpack melts, it releases that mercury as a slug to the ecosystem, just as it's waking up from the winter and is at its most vulnerable state.
So the team, this same team was up here last year and came up with the conclusion that, yes, there is bromine in the snow up here at Summit Greenland. And then now comes the big question about where is the bromine coming from? And next, Craig Clements is going to talk real quickly about some of the ways that we can try to determine where is that bromine coming from.
Hi, I'm Craig Clements. I'm from San Jose State University, and I'm up here to work with the atmospheric chemists and give them some measurements on the low-level atmospheric conditions. And when I say low-level, we're talking about the very near surface. So typically, weather systems expand from the surface all the way up through the troposphere. What we're really interested here is the near-surface conditions, so less than a kilometer deep or about 3,000 feet above the surface. And you can see that in the picture, there's a balloon. It's an orange blimp-shaped balloon. And we use that to measure profiles starting from the near surface up to about 900 meters above the ground, or about 2,000 feet. And that instrument that you see has cups, just like a weather station, and gives us wind speed. It also has a temperature sensor and a humidity sensor, so we can get profiles to better understand the vertical structure of the atmosphere, and hopefully this will lead us to a better understanding of the meteorology that may give us a better insight to what's going on and where the bromine's coming from.
Okay, and then Barry's going to talk real quickly about some more things to think about. So as this research is ongoing and as it's starting to wrap up this summer, what's next?
Thanks, Craig. So we know there's bromine up here now from our work last year. We haven't seen any chlorine at all. So the next question is, when we do those calculations for that ozone recipe and we add in the bromine, do we get the right ozone now? We've got a team of modelers, some from Europe and from the United States, that are going to help take this data and work with us and help answer that question. We think we're getting much closer. The levels of bromine are very low in the parts per trillion, but that's what we were expecting. But they're almost what we think. But we need more data, and we're hoping to get that soon. And so far this year, we are seeing bromine and at low levels, but and also the mercury is getting transformed that also shows that there's bromine present. Do we see enough bromine? We think so, but we need to double-check. And I think we can safely say, yes, the bromine does matter up here. But this is the third year of our project. It's going to be writing up this research and publishing some papers on that. And the next slide is Craig and advertising his blog about our research.
Hey, that mostly wraps it up from here. The picture you're looking at is another one of Barry's instruments, and it's a camera, a dome camera, that takes a picture every minute of the sky. And so it's a cloud cam, and I'll be posting some pictures of the cloud cam and some time-lapse video showing how the clouds are moving over the top of Summit Greenland. And then he and the other scientists can use that information to say how their instruments were affected by the clouds. So, I think I hand it back over to Arcus for questions or...
Okay. Thanks, everybody. So we're Craig and the group are ready for some questions, and since we don't have any students, it won't be too crazy, but you can either raise your hand if you have a question, type it in the text box, or if you got a question right now, just speak up.
I have a question for Katrine. This is Joe. I wanted to know, Katrine, what you found out from last year's data that you collected.
Hi, Joe. We from last year. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
We saw some interesting things in last year's data. It followed the same sort of trends as the previous years, which was good. We saw, because last year we were here in the spring, and so we saw the same sorts of things where the hydrocarbons are declining as we get more into the summer months. So that was good to see.
It's also nice to see you and Bonnie and Luke and Barry and the whole gang up there again. I'm following Craig's journal, and it's fun to see everybody.
Okay. And Robin Elwood's class has a question for you online, Craig. They are wondering how long it took you to ski to the site to work on the equipment and if there were any crevasses in the area.
That was from yesterday. I think it took us about an hour to ski out there. We got out to the 5-kilometer site, and then the electric snowmobile met us out there, which was nice, you know, to ski all that way and then see power coming towards you. But, and then we spent about an hour working out there and an hour and a half coming back in. So it took us a little while, and none of us are super accomplished on the skis, so I'm sure it was kind of funny to watch us at the beginning. By the end, we were starting to get it down pretty good.
Okay. And then Joe again has, how many electric snow machines do you have at Summit right now?
We have one electric snow machine, an experimental one from University of Wisconsin-Madison. They put that together as a team, and so we're keeping data for them and logging our usage so they can see, you know, how well does it work up here and how can they modify it for next year. It's got an EV1 engine, if anybody's familiar with the first major production of electric cars, and they shut those production down. Well, they've got a hold of one of those engines and put it in a snowmobile, and it's actually run off of batteries that you use for, like, handheld drills and construction equipment.
And so how do they charge those, Craig? Do they use a generator to charge them?
There are a couple generators up here. There is also a windmill installed, and hopefully the idea is that the windmill spins in the wind and creates electricity and charges up the snowmobile so that we are creating little if no pollution up here.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Okay, and then Joe has another question. How did the windmill work all winter long?
We'll have Kathy Young, the camp manager, come over and give us kind of a rundown of that stuff.
Yeah. Joe, it worked pretty well, except for come about the springtime in March, it stopped, and it just stopped turning completely. And so just last month, we had some folks come up, and they had to de-ice the blades and do a little maintenance on it, and now it is working just fine again. So we need to figure out how to deal with it in the really cold winter months when it's minus 65, minus 75, and the blades ice up.
Okay, and Craig, we got some additional questions relate that. The Upward Bound group wants to know, are there plans to use solar energy, especially in the summer with 24 hours of sunlight?
I will let somebody who knows far more about that field that question here. I think Kathy's going to scoot over and give us a rundown on that.
Right now what they've been working on is a long-term plan for Summit Camp. They would like to in the future, once we get funding, that's the thing that's holding us back, is to utilize solar energy, and the hope would be from Tracy Dow, who is working on this project, is to get a whole wind farm up here, but now we just have to wait for funding for that to happen. But that is the hope for Summit Camp.
Cool. Well, with the fuel crisis, we can all retreat to Summit Camp to go live. Flagstaff would like to know, are there any signs of the ice sheet melting at a faster rate?
Yeah, Barry's going to field that question for you.
That's a good question. From where we are at Summit, we can't tell that, but on the way here, there was a nice map showing Craig's trip here from Montana to New York, and then from New York to Kangerlussuaq, also known as Sondestrom Fjord, the longest fjord in Greenland. When we go home from Summit, we're going to go back to Kangerlussuaq, and we might have a day or so to explore, and most of us usually go to the ice edge. It's about 10-kilometer bike ride, and there you can see the ice sheet melting, and it's every year we go back there, it's retreated a little bit more. So, yeah, there are scientists in Greenland studying the total amount of ice there is up here, and each year it's decreasing, and trying to understand why the ice is melting probably a little faster than we used to think it would. So this is the place where climate change is going to be the most, the largest change in temperature and the most obvious up here in the Arctic. And Greenland is a big piece of ice that's going to, as it melts, it's going to raise sea level.
Okay. And we have a question from Jeff Peniston. Did you ever find meteorites on the glaciers of Greenland like they do in Antarctica?
I haven't found any, and in fact, I talked with Robbie Score, who is one of the logistics providers for people coming up here to Summit, and she used to study meteorites in Antarctica, and we just don't find them here, and I believe it's because the snow is piling up and covering a lot of that stuff up, and Antarctica is more or less a desert, so if stuff falls out of the sky and lands there, it stays on the surface for quite a while and doesn't get covered up as quickly. So we haven't found anything. However, today, this morning, as I was walking out to our satellite camp, I did see two small birds. We don't know what the fate of those birds will be, but they're a long way from probably where they should be.
Okay, great. Thanks. And I think that's it for now on the online. Anybody want to ask a question on the phone?
Janet, we have a group here that was curious about how often the conditions are right to have the sun dogs form.
Okay.
We'll let Kathy talk about that again and tell you how frequently the sun dogs show up.
The best way, I think, to answer that is when we have really clear days and it's cold and we get lots of ice crystals in the sky, and commonly known as what we call diamond dust. And when you have those particulars, then you usually see the big sun dogs and big halos around the sun. And springtime is actually when the folks who are wintering up here see a majority of them. And they're really beautiful.
Okay, great. Anybody else have questions? Okay. Well, if you think of something and you didn't get a chance to ask it today, be sure to post it in the Ask the Team section on that's associated with the research project on Craig's journal and project page on the website. And a couple of other things that we wanted to let you know. This, if you like talking to researchers today, we've got a couple of other Live from IPY events that are coming up. June 18th, we'll have a Live from IPY event that's actually an international event celebrating land and life in the polar regions, and it's part of the International Polar Years Organization days. And you, at this time, we're going to have Elizabeth Eubanks from reporting from Barrow, Alaska, and I think we're going to have an Antarctica researcher and another researcher from somewhere in the U.S. talking about coastal erosion on that day, so you can sign up for that Live from IPY event. And then we have Elizabeth again talking from Barrow on July 10th, and that one's on the website, and there's some other ones that are going to be scheduled coming up in the next couple of weeks as well. We just don't have them on the website. So stay tuned for other Live from IPY events. Again, this Live from IPY event will be archived and up on the web by probably by the end of the day. So if you want to review it or share it with others, that's a good way to do so. And otherwise, I want to thank Craig and everybody there at Summit Station. It's been a real pleasure working with you guys, and we enjoy following your journal. And have a good rest of your field season.
Well, and thank you to the group of you in Fairbanks that makes this possible for teachers to be able to do projects like this, and also for facilitating the workshop today. And I think all of us here would like to thank everybody for tuning in and joining our expedition up here at Summit Greenland. So thank you, and stay warm.
All right, thanks, Craig, and thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Craig.
Thank you.
All right, bye.